This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The World Health Organization says 100 countries are now reporting coronavirus cases, with more than 100,000 people ill. In Italy, a serious outbreak of the virus has locked down one quarter of its population. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
An eerie stillness settled over Italy's wealthy north on Sunday, after the government effectively quarantined 16 million people in a bid to contain the rapidly growing coronavirus outbreak. The country is Europe's hardest hit, and on Saturday reported that the number of cases had leapt by 1,200 in a 24-hour period, its biggest daily increase since the epidemic began in Italy 2 weeks ago. In response, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte signed unprecedented restrictions into law overnight. He announced that people should now not enter or leave Lombardy, Italy's richest region, including the financial center Milan, as well as 14 provinces in four other regions, including the cities of Venice, Modena, and Parma, among others.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Just off the coast of California, a cruise ship hit by the coronavirus is headed to the port of Oakland. Princess Cruises says it will dock on Monday. AP's Julie Walker reports.
The cruise ship can be seen moving off the coast. The captain told passengers last night those requiring acute medical treatment and hospitalization will be taken to healthcare facilities in California. Others will go to federally operated isolation sites or transported out of state. Passenger Karen Dever says she and her husband have been holed up in their room since Thursday, feel fine, and are anxious to get off the boat.
You know, at some point, it has to stop. So if they test me and say I'm negative, well, then let me go. You know, don't keep me.
The Grand Princess has about 24 reported cases of coronavirus. The ship is carrying more than 3,500 people. I'm Julie Walker.
For more on the coronavirus, go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. The ceasefire deal in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib remains in effect Sunday. Some of the area's residents have returned since the ceasefire began last week, only to discover that their homes have been destroyed. The fighting in the region since late last year has triggered a massive humanitarian crisis, with almost a million people fleeing their homes. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he will meet with European Union officials in Brussels on Monday to discuss the influx of migrants in Turkey. As migrants from Syria continue to cross into Turkey, Erdogan said Ankara can no longer abide by the 2016 law that prevents migrants in Turkey from traveling into the European Union. U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, a former 2020 Democratic presidential candidate, says she will endorse Joe Biden's bid for president.
I am supporting Joe because I believe that he is a man who has lived his life with great dignity. He is a public servant who has always worked for the best of who we are as a nation, and we need that right now. There is so much at stake in this election, guys.
Biden's primary rival for the nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders, says he's also been getting a lot of endorsements.
Look, we have the support of virtually every major grassroots organization representing millions of workers, black and brown and white. We have the support of a number of major unions in this country.
Sanders made the comment on ABC's This Week. The number of female parliamentarians in the world has more than doubled since the groundbreaking UN Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing 25 years ago. Lisa Schlein has more on where things stand.
While female representation in national parliaments has increased, gender parity remains a distant dream. However, significant changes have occurred. In 1995, the top-ranked country in terms of female members of parliament was Sweden, followed by other Nordic and developed countries. This year, Rwanda, with more than 60% female MPs, beat 171 other countries for the top spot, followed by Cuba, Bolivia, and United Arab Emirates. Sweden has been bumped down to seventh position. The Interparliamentary Union finds countries in the Americas have made the most progress in terms of representation of women in parliament, followed by Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and North Africa and Asia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Women around the world are marking International Women's Day with marches to raise awareness of discrimination against women. People have been marking March 8th as a special day for women for more than a century. For more on any of today's top news stories, go to voanews.com or use the VOA mobile app. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us. And here are the issues. As the coronavirus spreads, so does the fear and the economic damage. When will it be brought under control? The U.S. presidential race narrows to just two Democrats. One, of course, will take on President Trump this fall. Another election in Israel and a U.S. Taliban peace plan appears shaky just days after it was signed. Well, let's start with this coronavirus, the one story spreading around the world, almost as spreading as quickly as the virus itself. Apparently, this is not just a health story, of course. It's an economic story as well. Airlines, cruise ships, manufacturing plants, supply chains, on and on and on, deeply affected by this. I guess the first question, and we'll start with you, Richard. When will this virus be brought under control, and at what cost?
It's a very good question. And the only answer I can give you at the moment is looking at what's happening in China. China has adopted draconian measures. And now we see that there's no new cases in this province of Hubei, with its capital Wuhan, after having been the center of the epidemic at the beginning. So I think it looks like at this very moment, from where it started, the virus has been contained. But now it's propagating all over the world. I just read this case in the UK, a woman who hadn't traveled and was not in contact with somebody who was sick. So there's still a lot we have to learn about the virus while it's still spreading, trying to figure out what form will it take and how does it go from one person to another.
In the latest numbers globally, more than 100,000 confirmed cases now, about 3,300 deaths. These figures from a database compiled by Johns Hopkins University, which is a very well-regarded university here in the United States. And Tom, the same question I asked Richard. What is your sense based on everything you've read and people you've spoken with and so forth? When will this be brought under control? And again, at what cost?
Well, the cost will be in the tens of billions of dollars at a minimum, maybe even a few trillion dollars worldwide. And I think this will not be under control by the end of the year. I mean, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States have estimated that a vaccine for this virus probably will not be readily available for a year to 18 months in a best-case scenario. So I think this is, I wouldn't say it's open-ended. It will end at some point. But the notion that President Trump has said that it'll probably get better in April when the warm weather comes, scientists, they'd like the president to be right, but they don't think he is. I think we're talking months and maybe even a year or two.
Well, he's no doctor and he has no experience in these sorts of immunology issues and so forth. So it's perhaps more important to listen to what the actual experts say. And among their findings so far, I mean, opinions vary, but there seems to be kind of a general consensus that the death rate for this is, again, the numbers tend to vary, but 2% to 2.5%, in other words, one of every 40 or 50 people who get this, which is very different than the flu, which is what the president has said. He said, well, it's just like the flu. Statistically, the number of people who perish from the flu is far lower than that in proportional terms. So one out of every 40 or 50, that's a rather alarming figure.
Yeah, it's a very heavy figure. And this is why it adds to the necessity of getting organized and getting ready. And even if the president is definitely not a specialist in this type of issue and crisis, he has looked at and listened to for advices, and at the moment he is fed into more confusion. And I mean, at the White House, the first briefing we attended, there is a mix of signals: be careful, wash your hands, don't touch your face, but don't worry about stuff. The president want to minimize the danger, but at a certain moment, his own scientific team, the doctors around him, the specialists, the experts, say you have to take all this seriously. The vice president himself, he sent the signal that every American could be tested, and now we don't have enough. We won't definitely have enough testing diagnostic kits to do this. So the population at the moment in the U.S., we have been receiving, even if we've heard the specialists from the CDCs with very clear indication on the state of the spreading of this virus, the political attitude towards this from the White House has created more confusion with the hesitation and the self-protection than anything else.
And on the issue, as long as Richard is bringing up the issue of politics here, Tom, it's a fair question. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign. We're going to go a little bit more in depth in just a minute. What about the political impact on the presidential race here? President Trump says everything is under control, all evidence to the contrary.
That's exactly right. The president is in serious damage control mode. His very first public statements about this were to talk about how 25,000 people in America die from the flu every year, suggesting, as you said earlier, Paul, that's a bigger problem than the virus. Of course, that's not the case. The president is trying to project leadership, but it's hard for him because he doesn't have details. He's not good at details. So I think it's probably wise for him to have turned this over to Vice President Pence, who was more prone to listen to the experts and more prone to be dealing with Democrats and others. These are the sorts of things that presidents always get more blame or credit than they often deserve. And this is an issue where the president will take some hits politically if this virus gets much, much worse. And if it's contained by summer, then that'll be better for him. But, I mean, he's very nervous because this is going to be a tough campaign, which we'll talk about. But he doesn't need to have something like this because people are scared. And he's trying to calm people down. But I must tell you, there are some in the White House who know there are going to be a lot more cases of the virus here. There are going to be many more deaths coming. Vice President Pence has talked euphemistically about more sad news to come. They don't want to talk too much about that because they know that that's not good for President Trump.
And there's a report by the investment bank Goldman Sachs, a big investment bank here in the United States, that kind of looking out to November, they say that this potentially could cost President Trump the election in November, depending, of course, on the severity and the length of this crisis. Well, let's talk about, in fact, big developments in the U.S. presidential race this week. On the Democratic side, it has really narrowed. I think it's fair to say now that it's down to just two people, former Vice President Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. He, of course, the senator from Vermont. What's interesting, and I'll start with you this time, Tom, Joe Biden, just even 2 weeks ago, seemed like his campaign might have been over. Now, all of a sudden, I think he's the front runner. What happened?
Well, some of our listeners here, longtime listeners, have probably heard me say this before because I say it a lot. I say it so much that my youngest son says, "Dad, I don't want to hear this anymore." But it is true. Overnight is a lifetime in politics. Anything can happen, and often it does. You're right. A week ago, I was having lunch with an old Republican friend of mine who said, "Well, Biden's going to win the South Carolina primary on the strength of the African-American vote, but he has no money. So what? He win in South Carolina, but that's the end of him. He has no money for television ads and everything." And then the next thing you know, there are 14 contests on the so-called Super Tuesday primaries. Biden won 10, Sanders won 4. And at the moment,
including, of course, the big one, California.
Right, yeah. Exactly right. So Biden has gone from dead in the water to leading, and there's another thing going on here. It's not just African-American voters. I think the biggest story of Biden's resuscitation, at least, and perhaps resurgence, is that it seems like the party is starting to clarify what's really important to them. And I think what the Democrats have decided is most important is getting rid of President Trump. So if they love Senator Elizabeth Warren or if they love somebody else, they're looking for someone who can retire President Trump prematurely.
And Richard, on that point, there's kind of a phrase in American politics. I think Lyndon Johnson kind of coined the phrase, the big tent. You want as many people in your tent as possible. And if you look at sort of who voted for Biden, some voting at the last minute, changing their mind, switching from Sanders and so forth, with the exception of so-called millennials, younger people who Sanders thought would come out for him in droves as usual, they stayed home. Younger people tend not to vote as much as older people. It looks like Biden got not just the black vote, but he got a lot of Hispanics and suburban women and just across the board. In other words, the big tent, he has a lot of different constituencies in his tent, which from a political standpoint, very impressive.
Yes, it's probably the reason why in the end, and very quickly, actually, we're saying the end, but mid-March could be over. This race could be easily over. There are primaries on March 17 in Florida, in Illinois, in Ohio, Arizona, major states. And if this trend continues, former vice president is going to continue getting wins all over the place. His tent is big. What's surprising is that Bernie Sanders, from the start, insisted on the fact that he was bringing to the Democratic Party new voters, new enthusiastic voters. And indeed, as much as we have to acknowledge the success the former Vice President has had on Super Tuesday, his rallies have been much smaller and far less exciting than Bernie Sanders. And it's, as Tom underlined, there's a fatalistic reflex to say, okay, we want to beat Trump, so he's going to be our horse. But I'm not sure in the end it's a dynamic, positive choice that they're making. I'm not sure that the Bernie's supporters, the ones, the millennials, but also the ones that got involved, there's a lot of Latinos also, Hispanics in there, are going to jump on the, okay, well, we have to choose someone to be Trump. He's going to be the one and we're going to do it. I'm not sure that they were with Bernie for this reason. They wanted something more, and Joe Biden is not offering it to them.
Is it too early then, as Richard seems to be suggesting, Tom, is it too early to be kind of talking about a Biden-Trump showdown?
I don't think it's too early. I mean, I would agree that Biden is not inevitable. As I've said before, you never know what's going to happen. He has a tendency for gaffes. As a Republican who was gearing up to deal with Biden says, there's something about Joe Biden. He's gotten old, and the spark plugs aren't fully connected to his engine. So they think they can make a lot of, the Republicans think they can make a lot of hay against Biden's tendency to say things or misspeak or gaffes or all of this kind of stuff. But it's interesting to note that at one point there was a sense that Bernie Sanders was going to get to the convention in Milwaukee with not enough delegates to be nominated, but leading the pack. And the sense was, if there's a contested convention and the party moguls, the movers and shakers and brokers go to a smoke-filled room and take it away from Sanders, there will be a revolution in the party. That's not going to happen. I mean, the fact that Biden is ahead now is a result of the ballot, not as a result of smoke-filled room bargaining.
Okay. More to come on that, obviously, in the coming weeks and months. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. There's been yet another election in Israel, the third one in the past year. Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, the longest serving prime minister, and Benny Gantz, his challenger. Netanyahu won this election, but the question is, and has always been, can he actually assemble a governing coalition there? That's been sort of the holdup that both of these men have faced. Can he do it this time, Richard?
Doesn't look like it. He claimed rightfully victory that time because his party, again, came in first, the Likud. But his coalition of hardline, smaller allies could not reach more than 58 seats. They need 61 in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to be able to govern. And Benny Gantz, the opposition, and the other parties definitely will not be able to form a parallel coalition. Benny Gantz, center-right, it's vague, but the other ones, the Arab Joint List, is the third biggest party now in Israel with 15 seats. And Benny Gantz said he was not going to count on these votes. So you're in a situation where, again, Israel doesn't look like it's going to have a stable government. And Benjamin Netanyahu needs to remain in power if he wants to avoid justice, which looks down at him in the middle of the month.
And speaking of justice, as Richard was just saying, it's really kind of an odd situation. Tom, Netanyahu, of course, faces trial just any day now on these charges of bribery and corruption. Now, to me, bribery and corruption sound like pretty serious issues, and yet there are a lot of voters who don't seem to be particularly bothered by that.
Well, but as things go, you don't want to have to deal with a trial like that in the middle of a governmental crisis here. And I think there's a certain number of Israelis here who have kind of, you get a sense that they're just kind of fed up with Netanyahu. Because of that, I think many in the various factions are reluctant to put to sign on with him, making the whole notion of forging a unity government or even a minority government harder. So I don't know what's going to happen. Well, it's quite possible, unless one of these scenarios find a handful of members of the Knesset to switch sides, it's not beyond possibility that you could have a fourth election this summer. So institutionally, it's chaos at the top of the governing situation in Israel, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be sorted out anytime soon.
Now, what if happened as this electoral standoff continues, possibility, as you say, of a fourth election? What happens if the sitting prime minister is convicted of these bribery charges and he's still the prime minister? What happens?
Well, I think if he's still prime minister, the charges can be brought. They'll have to be postponed. So we're in a situation where at the moment he's the government. He's going to keep governing the country because there's no coalition unless there's a blue and white, which is Benny Gantz's party, and Likud coalition. But then Benny Gantz said he would never serve under Benjamin Netanyahu. Could there be a way within the Likud to say we're going to put aside Benjamin Netanyahu? It's hard to imagine at this moment. I also noticed that in the meantime, if the Israelis seem to be divided on everything, they seem to agree on the fate of the Palestinian territories. Benny Gantz and Benjamin Netanyahu agree on the solution brought forward by the Americans, Jared Kushner, the present son-in-law, with his plan in the end, which implies annexation of the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories. Even this week, Jared Kushner has talked to senators saying if the Palestinians are not ready to negotiate on what we suggested, we're going to go ahead and recognize the annexation of these settlements, Israeli settlements. So while there's political instability in Israel, the Palestinians are the major loser in this reality.
Well, speaking of peace plans, we've got to move on here. We've got that peace plan, which does not appear to be going anywhere. In the meantime, another peace plan, this one signed between the United States and Taliban, ostensibly aimed at ending what has been an 18-year war between the U.S. and the Taliban ever since the United States invaded Afghanistan after the terror attacks on New York and Washington in 2001, an 18-year war. But even that peace plan signed again just a couple of days ago, Tom, looks shaky already.
Yes, U.S. Military forces have launched strikes against Taliban, who they said was threatening military and coalition forces there. There's been a new wave of bombings, political suicide bombings in the area. And now both sides are saying, well, we didn't say the violence would have to stop. We agreed to reduce violence as a goodwill gesture. But that was going to be difficult, at least from a distance. The so-called deal in Afghanistan with the Taliban seems to have crumbled before it really got underway. I mean, it's not that many days ago that President Trump got on the phone and spoke for the first time in 18 years with the leader of the Taliban. They both said all the right things, and yet violence continues. So, I think Afghanistan has, for centuries, has been a problem for great powers who thought they could impose their will. The British, the Soviets. Now the Americans are learning. And President Trump really wants to get out of Afghanistan. And President Trump is learning that it's harder to work your will and easier said than done to do what you want to do and get your troops out of there, which he really wants to see troops come home by the election.
Well, they don't call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires for nothing. But when, you know, it seems to me that we're going to have, just my view here, is that we're going to have troops in Afghanistan for a very long time, even just a token force. And there are some people who say, and just to quickly, Richard, give me your view. I mean, the United States has had troops in Germany for 75 years. We've been in Korea for about 70 years now. And perhaps one way of looking at it is it that they have a kind of a, at least some say, a stabilizing influence. And in Korea, certainly a tripwire in the event of trouble there. Is there anything so bad about just maintaining a small force in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's we kind of understood after the Second World War and the Korean War that the American forces were necessary. In this very case, it looks more, because fundamentally the reason why the Americans were on the ground was to fight Al-Qaeda after 9/11. Our listeners have to know and understand that not only the president wants to bring back the soldiers, but the American people are not interested in keeping soldiers over there. So we can have special forces on the ground to fight. The Americans can have special forces on the ground to fight extremists here and there. But in the end, the president doesn't care about appearances, and it's only appearances that justify at the moment American forces on the ground. Appearances, the fate of women, their place in society, their role, the position of ethnic minorities trying to avoid being overwhelmed by the Pashtuns, the central government, the appearance of credibility in a very corrupt environment. All these appearances, it's the only reason why we keep soldiers, the Americans keep soldiers there, because the Taliban are not anymore the terrorists they were in the past, but the nationalist forces who are trying to kick out the foreigners in their land. So in the end, I do not see how the president can lose on this. The agreement, the peace agreement is weak, is not clear, but in the end, he's going to win because nobody in the U.S. is really seriously fighting to keep soldiers over there.
All right, we're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank, his contributing editor to National Journal, and Richard LaTendresse, he's correspondent here in Washington for TV8 Nouvelles Canada. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks very much for joining us.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA international broadcaster and current affairs producer, Kim Lewis. Our topic on this edition of the program, commemorating International Women's Day and Women's History Month, honoring and celebrating the vital role of women in American history. Our guest, Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, former U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Malta and the longest-serving U.S. Ambassador to that small, strategically located European island country. A 30-year diplomat, Ambassador Abercrombie Winstanley has had a long and distinguished career in public service. She has held numerous senior positions, including advisor to the commander of U.S. cyber forces on foreign policy priorities, deputy coordinator for counterterrorism, special assistant to the Secretary of State for Middle East and Africa, and chairwoman for Middle East Area Studies at the Foreign Service Institute. She has also held senior positions at the Defense Department and at the White House National Security Council. Prior to that, she was a fellow on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for then-ranking member Senator Joe Biden, currently a contender in the Democratic race for president in 2020. Throughout her career, Ambassador Abercrombie Winstanley has done extensive work advocating for diversity and inclusion, including a mission to Saudi Arabia, where she actively supported gender equality in the region. She is also co-chair and founder of LC Wins, the Leadership Council of Women in National Security, and that's an organization which advances gender equity in the national security workforce, especially its leadership. She has moderated discussions at respected international think tanks on issues ranging from U.S. Mideast policy, the importance of diversity and inclusion in U.S. foreign policymaking, cybersecurity challenges, and counterterrorism. Ambassador Abercrombie Winstanley is currently diplomat in residence in Oberlin College in the state of Ohio. And she joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Madam Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And of course, I'm delighted to welcome my special colleague, Kim Lewis, our current affairs producer and booker.
Thanks, Carol. Good to be here.
Well, Ambassador Abercrombie Winstanley, we're so happy to have you as we celebrate and commemorate International Women's Day. I want you to talk first about your many years in the Republic of Malta. How do you see the importance of Malta over the years and what you learned from your experience there?
Well, Malta is an extraordinary country, as you mentioned. It has a very strategic position in the Mediterranean. Part of our bilateral relationship focused on training, search and rescue missions, maritime training. And we reached out to other navies in the region, from Morocco, from Libya, from Tunisia, to do training there. And the United States and Malta had a great partnership. Working with resettling refugees is another part of the relationship that we have with Malta. It is the only nation in the European Union where the United States actively resettles refugees from. First, they go to Malta, they go through a two-year screening period, and then come into the United States. We had a very close cooperation on counterterrorism issues, again, because of where they're located and their membership in the European Union. So we work together on a lot of really important issues. And then, of course, the country's history with having been in wars with the Ottoman Empire, with the French invasion, with the British invasion, their close relationship with the Italians. I mean, it's a very rich history.
Tell me, remind us what years you were there.
I arrived in early 2012 and I left in 2016.
Ambassador, I know you think it's very important to have women and other types of people in the national security establishment, minorities and so forth. You are co-founder of LC Wins, as we said in the introduction, and I'd like you to talk about why you think that kind of diversity enhances and strengthens our foreign and national security policy.
Like any good organization, we are strengthened when we bring a wide array of values, of experiences, of thought processes to the table in order to find solutions. The greater range of people you have discussing an issue, the greater number of options you have for finding success. If you have a bunch of people with a very similar background, you're going to have a very narrow range of things to look at, to explore. So that broader range is important. Women bring different things to the table. Minorities bring different things to the table that help make the policies coming out at the other end better, stronger, making sure that different aspects are considered as we reach that policy. National security is something that's important for every nation around the world, and obviously no nation can say they're doing it perfectly based on the state of the world today. So the more interaction we have, the broader our thought processes are, I think the more successful we can be in effecting longer-lasting solutions.
I'd like to turn to my colleague, Kim, for some questions.
Yes, Ambassador, you have lived in so many different regions of the world, and you've had a chance to really see some of the struggles of women in different circumstances that you might not see from here in America. So from your experience, what are some areas where women have made great strides in terms of having a voice and where they live, and some areas that remain a huge challenge for them?
You're right. There are challenges around the world that American women possibly couldn't even imagine. But the thing that unites us wherever we are is our resilience and our strength. I would say that in Saudi Arabia, which of course has made some important changes in the last few years, allowing women to drive, legally allowing women to travel without the permission of a male relative, which was a perfectly ridiculous thing to have to imagine that you might have to get permission from your 14-year-old son if you did not have a husband or a father living or no brother. It would be your son who would say to you, "Mom, yes, you can travel abroad." And certainly that irritation and frustration was experienced by my Saudi friends and colleagues. Still, there are challenges for them with regard to their access to the judicial system. So there are other things that need to be done to be able to represent, be present in court, to stand up for your legal rights, to have yourself fairly represented is still a challenge in the country. And indeed, in any nation where there is a very conservative government or cultural outlook, it can be very difficult. Afghanistan would be another place. In Malta, it's a very conservative country for Europe. I think it's probably one of the most conservative in that it's got a relatively low participation rate of women in the workforce. It's growing. I had the privilege of working with three presidents of Malta while I was there. And one of them was a woman, Mary Louise Calero Preco, who was really strong for women and family rights and did a great deal to forward that, those rights. So it was good to see that.
Good. And you also mentioned earlier refugees.
Yeah.
So how are refugee women? What are some of the things that they are doing or what's being done to help empower them?
Well, again, the most important thing is for women to know our rights, so that we can advocate for ourselves. But as a refugee, you are so vulnerable for violence. As you know, women and children are far more vulnerable for sexual violence and other forms of violence when they are unprotected on these routes from Africa, from Asia, other nations where they're coming to Europe and other countries for safety. There are challenges for women for ensuring that they're getting the proper medical care. There are issues that way. So it really is a matter of knowing your rights, being able to advocate for yourself, and identify sources of support.
Ambassador, I'd like to get your observations about today's very polarized political climate, not just here, even in the United States, but even abroad.
Around the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're seeing enormous polarization and the rise of the far right, both abroad and even here, one can say, in the United States. We are witnessing the rise of a white supremacist movement. So in terms of polarization, how is it qualitatively different or not, maybe, from your years as a diplomat?
It is a recent phenomenon for us all to recognize it. I think white supremacy or far-right views, xenophobia has been out there forever, but our norms around the world have suppressed, if not the thought processes, the behavior, the willingness to say things out loud. It was not socially acceptable to say you don't like the other for whatever reason. And those constraints have been released. So people feel quite at ease to say, I don't want someone of a different color, of a different gender, of a different sexual orientation to be with me, near me. They shouldn't have access to, and that didn't used to be the case. The United States, as we have been brought up to value tolerance, to value individual rights, civil rights, with all of that that it encompasses, and to go around the world sharing those values, recognizing that even when we failed, we were trying to meet those values. That's the issue. And as a diplomat for 30 years, we have a very checkered history in this country, as you know. But I've always been able to say with complete honesty, we fail, but we are always trying to improve ourselves. And we look at our failures. We examine those failures. We don't try and hide them. After 9/11, when many Americans realized we'd gone too far with the Patriot Act, I was able to point out that the organization that led the first and most critical report, examination of how we were conducting ourselves after 9/11, was the Department of Justice. It was the Inspector General who said the Department of Justice has gone too far. Law enforcement in the United States has gone too far. So we looked at ourselves. We looked at ourselves when McCarthyism, anti-communism, and we were persecuting innocent people, but we held public hearings and we criticized ourselves. That I hope we're not going to lose. And this is a very difficult time for the United States. I have friends from around the world who say, ah, you learn too much from us instead of teaching us about you. And that, as a diplomat, as an American, is very painful. And I am trusting that we will continue to look at ourselves and correct.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. She was the longest-serving U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Malta. She has held numerous senior national security and foreign policy positions throughout the U.S. government. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA international broadcaster and our current affairs producer, Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Faisal Jadi from Swat, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our special guest, Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. Let me ask you, Madam Ambassador, picking up on what Kim said earlier about refugees, the challenges for females. Another setback here, many would say, in the United States is the fact that the United States is taking fewer and fewer refugees since World War II. And we know that President Trump is very much at the forefront of this particular policy and also trying to reduce immigration, even legal immigration. To what extent does this concern you, since really immigrants and refugees have been the backbone of this country, have enriched our country, and those who advocate for them are not saying we want open borders and no rules, but they're saying where we're going now, we're going backwards, back to the 1920s, or with respect to trade even, back to the 1950s with our anti-trade policies. Again, not saying that we shouldn't have fair trade agreements, but to try to impose tariffs and so forth. Again, I'm sort of conflating everything, but what is your view in particular vis-a-vis refugees and immigration?
The United States has been a leader around the world advocating for refugees. It has been a position that has allowed us to get other countries to help as well. And this has been extraordinarily important. No one should think we believe that we have taken the most refugees around the world, because we haven't. The countries that take the most refugees are those that are adjacent to the hotspots. And so it's Turkey, it's Pakistan, it's Lebanon, it's Jordan. Those are the countries that are bearing the full brunt of the presence of refugees. And of course, most refugees want to go home again. So they don't want to come to the United States or to Europe. And so the fact that we can help and should help, it's been part of our basic fiber in the United States to help others and to recognize the value of immigrants. Again, we've been here before. Xenophobia crops up in every nation now and again. I'm certain are going to correct on this one as well, because we need them. And I know there have been reports in recent days where I believe the acting chief of staff was overheard saying that we need immigrants. We've got to have people working in our factories, living in our homes. I'm living in Ohio right now in a state that has seen a little increase in population, but not nearly as much as there are homes that are empty. So we're going to correct on this, I feel very strongly, but we have to keep speaking truth. We have to make sure that people understand that when there are job losses, for the vast majority of cases, it is not immigrants coming in. It is technology that is changing the type of jobs that are out there. And we've got to have those who are advocating for greater technology, those who are captains of industry, to think hard about what are the people that are being made redundant, being unemployed, what are they going to do? We've got to find jobs for people who are losing their work to technology.
Indeed, and they have to be retrained.
Absolutely.
And that should be our policy. Yeah.
Yes, and this was going to really lead right into my question regarding technology and what role it is playing today, especially regarding women and how it influences people. It changes people's behavior. It changes their thought process. I mean, technology really is a big influencer today. So how does it affect the role of women?
It's a double-edged sword. It can give you a greater voice, a farther reach using technology, using social media of many sorts, but it also can be used against women to abuse us, to intimidate us, to make us afraid, and to drive us, in fact, from public space. When people flame you, when trolls come after you because you're speaking your position, your truth on social media, and people don't like what's being heard. I've noticed it because I'm a huge science fiction fan, and hearing some of the concerns about more women and more minorities in roles that were traditionally held by European American men or European men. And I remember reading a commentary from someone who is in the Star Trek universe commenting that anyone complaining that there's a woman captain or a woman lead in a Star Trek universe, that is what Star Trek was about. And if you're really a fan, you cannot disagree with it. You can't complain about it. That should be what you can expect. So women have been able to take our place, I think, more so in technology fields, but we've been there all along. In coding, in computers, for instance, some of the most famous and most adept coders were women at the very beginning of this industry. So the work now is to make sure that knowledge is known, and that's so often the way. For minorities and for women, we've been there, but the history has not been shared.
Yes, I think one of them just passed away. She worked for NASA. She was 101 years old.
That's right, from Hidden Figures.
Yes.
Yeah, a great movie, but she is a great example of women's important role that has not been sufficiently publicized. And we're working on that now. I know a young woman who's working on getting Wikipedia pages up for women in the past and women now, to just put it out there what we're doing in the sphere of national security, in the sphere of arts, etc., because we don't get enough publicity.
That's right. And also, I think men have to realize that women aren't taking their places. We're in a competitive environment. Women are reaching these positions on their merit, and even more so because it's more, they are discriminated against often. And so I think some in particular, white males are, you know, concerned. But look, women have been discriminated against, have not had the same opportunities. And it's not a lack of opportunity. They just, everyone has to work for what they earn.
Absolutely. And the other half of that is that space is being made for men to broaden what they get to do as well. Certainly for both of our children, because I was the lead in our career with my husband. He's an engineer, but he followed me around the world for 30 years. And I will be honest, to a little bit of envy when our daughter was an infant and he got to spend more time with her than I did. And I had to recognize that as well. You know, it's a mixed bag for everyone. We've got to find what roles work best for us. As anyone will tell you, within a marriage, there's only two people and you have to make it work how it works for you. Sometimes it's more or less traditional. Mine was less traditional. But we have two grown-up children. They're alive and sane, and so, yay.
Ambassador, I wanted to ask you back to what we're witnessing with the bureaucracy here in the United States, the backbone of our government, in a sense, public servants working for the government. We're seeing now what some call retribution in the wake of President Trump's so-called acquittal by the Senate. He has since criticized and fired many civil servants, diplomats who were responding to legally enforced subpoenas and agreed to give truthful testimony to the House of Representatives during the impeachment inquiry. Are you worried about the type of vengeance that he has directed at, for example, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a Purple Heart recipient who was recently walked out of the White House simply for testifying, even Trump mega-donor Gordon Sondland, who was summarily removed from his ambassadorship to the EU because he testified negatively but in effect truthfully about President Trump's behavior? Are you worried about this type of potential deleterious effects on our society and even the integrity of our democratic government?
I will say that with regard to the retribution against those who testified in the impeachment trial of the president, in fact, we've had 2+ years, 3 years that our expectations should not have been any different about what would happen as a result. That said, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, I think, will be fine, even if his work in the White House was terminated early. And with regard to Sondland, as a political appointee particularly, but even as a professional diplomat ambassador, we serve at the pleasure of the president. So at any time, if the president says, you no longer are my representative, then you're done as an ambassador. And it can be done for any reason. It is deeply troubling to have the civil service afraid to tell the truth. That is their job. They work for the American people. They take an oath to the Constitution, not to an individual. I believe strongly that this too shall pass, and that this is an opportunity, as bad as it appears to be now, to look at what we have laid out, what we thought we had with regard to our checks and balances, and to recognize that they're only as good as the reasonable person in the White House allows them to be, or as only as good as the Congress is willing to do its job. Because if the Congress were doing its job, we would not be in this situation. Different things would have happened.
Well, speaking of that, Madam Ambassador, speaking of the Congress, the Republican-controlled Senate is currently refusing to take up legislation to safeguard our elections, particularly to thwart outside interference from nefarious actors like Russia in particular, who was clearly the culprit in interfering in the 2016 elections, regardless of what President Trump says. This was confirmed by 11 intelligence agencies. So I'm curious about your optimism, because if the Republican-controlled Senate is refusing to take up legislation, refuses to acknowledge that this is a threat to our democracy, I'm wondering, where do you get your optimism?
I get my optimism because we have an election coming up and we'll see what the American people think about this. The press has been largely doing its job by informing us, but we also have to do our own due diligence. We all know that our knowledge, our information is siloed, and we have to take on that responsibility to ensure that we're hearing from a variety of sources of information so that we can make our own decisions. I think there's enough information out there. People understand, really, that things have been tampered with. Some believe it. Most people believe it. Some don't. I recognize that. But an election is coming and the American people will speak, and it's going to shape the future of our nation, and we'll see what we want for ourselves. It's really up to us. I think we're going to do the right thing, but we'll see.
Indeed. Well, just to follow up quickly, because what we're seeing is the Republican Party in particular is adopting some of the same conspiracy theories that the Russians are floating about, you know, whether that it was Ukraine, not Russia, who interfered in 2016 and many other things. So it's one thing that we're having foreign interference across the social media platform, the lack of safeguarding, let's say, the hardware of our elections by refusing to pass legislation to bolster our
election security.
Exactly.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we're seeing, you know, some of this very disinformation coming right from those who were engaged in the elections. So whether it's the Republican Party or whomever working on their behalf is spreading these kinds of disinformation.
Yeah. Well, I think we all understand for one reason or another that we need better controls over those companies that provide the social media platforms, whether it is because they are refusing to put in place, they're making lots of money, so it's not like they're short of money.
But that's precisely why they're not doing anything.
Exactly. I understand that. So it is going to take legislation to effect that change, to better protect our privacy, to give us real control over whether we want to be tracked, over whether we want our information shared, and over whether our information should be monetized for others as opposed to ourselves. We need the Congress to take up legislation for that, and election security is a very, very important part of it. There are a number of organizations that are advising Republican and Democratic members of Congress and staff so they better understand what the cost and what possible solutions are for many of these technology, social media related problems are. And the most important thing is to get them to understand what's going on, because many don't even know what questions to ask. So that's where we're starting now, and that's underway. I hope nothing horrible has to happen before we put in place better controls. History suggests that it might, but hope springs eternal.
And also, on just looking at that situation in this age of information, what advice would you give young women who are wanting to, you know, maybe go into the government or who want to go into politics and may be in a country where they don't have the same freedoms as in Western countries? What advice would you give them in terms of telling the truth and speaking out, either suppressing or giving information?
Well, the first thing I would say for any young woman anywhere, United States or any other country, is that we always have to do our homework. We always have to have a good understanding of the circumstances in which we want to flourish. So that means knowing where the power centers are, knowing what is acceptable behavior, and then pushing the envelope on that, because you got to make change, and that means you are going to have to step beyond accepted bounds. But those change daily. Doing the homework, making sure that you have a good support system around you, I'd say personally, even as important as professionally, because there are times when you are going to feel that you made no progress at all or you were sent two big steps back. And that's when you need to go and gather yourself, re-energize your spirit to start again, not to give up, because there are examples in history throughout the world of women who have done extraordinary things in the face of great opposition. So the examples are out there for us. Put those in our minds, recognize that we can do more.
Now, you've had an extraordinary life, so what would you like your legacy to be?
I am hoping to leave behind many, many empowered young women who understand, yes, we can do it. We can do it. Step out of our way. That we're going to be part of the solution. That we can make things better for this world. Step out of our way and let us do it. And if you can't let us, step out of our way, because we're going to do it.
Well, on that very hopeful and positive note, I'd like to thank Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. She's the former U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Malta, now a public speaker and foreign affairs consultant. Madam Ambassador, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights. As we honor Women's History Month, you certainly exemplify the vital role of women in American history and foreign policy.
Thank you. It was a privilege.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. And our engineer was Al Santos. And joining me on the program was VOA international broadcaster and current affairs producer Kim Lewis. I'm Carol Castiel. Please join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.